there. I'm Dr. Gabe Lowe, and welcome to the Hard Questions, No Answers podcast. This is a show that is less interested in answering life's difficult questions and more interested in the process of wrestling with them. This podcast is a forum to celebrate the messiness that makes us human. It is a place to invite the unanswerable questions because often it is precisely these types of questions that push us to dig deeper, to think harder, and to refine our approach to life. So, if you get to the end of the episode and you still have lots of questions, then I've done my job. I invite you on the pursuit of no answers. My guest today is a dear friend of mine, Dr. Carrie Harrell. We are cohort mates at the Rosemead School of Psychology at Biola University, where she wrote her dissertation on benevolent sexism and flourishing in the evangelical population. She is an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Baylor College of Medicine and a staff psychologist at the Menninger Clinic. Her current research surrounds the intersection of gender and sexuality-related beliefs and religion. Please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Carrie Harrell.
I can call you Dr. Carrie Harrell now, or I know, isn't that crazy? I don't know if we've called each other doctors. I mean, because
I addressed your Christmas cards to the doctors.
Dr.
Lowe and Louie. But you're welcome to call me whatever you'd like. Call me Dr. Harrell, Dr. Carrie.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, I'm probably gonna call you Carrie because that's how we knew each other, and
I think that makes the most sense.
Well, it's so good to see you. I mean, we spent so much time together in graduate school, which feels like forever ago now. Anything before COVID feels like forever ago now, to be fair. But I'm so glad to sit down with you. You have always had such great thoughts, and I'm excited to pick your brain today. I don't even know where to start exactly in terms of there's so many different directions that we could go, but I did want to talk about sort of how you got into the world of gender studies, because I remember when you first were at Rosemead, you were already in that boat and you were already full steam ahead. So was that something that you had already acquired an interest in? Is that something that you'd already done some work or some research in? Or was that something that you came into Rosemead like, hey, this is what I want to do, and you know, I want to jump in?
It was definitely more the latter, because when I was applying to graduate school, I had sort of sold myself or was touting myself as wanting to do child psychology because I had been a nanny for many years. I used to work in children's ministry in the church. And so I thought that was what would make the most sense. And I genuinely thought, like, I really wanted to work with kids, which is not untrue, but it's not what I wanted to do. Once I got to graduate school, I realized that was not totally the direction. And that is when I first heard about there at Rosemead, there is a research group, particularly dedicated to gender issues. And when I first started hearing about the types of research or types of studies they were doing, I was captivated, because I thought, there are people who are thinking about this. There are people who are researching it, who have thoughts about this. And so at that point in my life, it wasn't necessarily that I had done anything scholarly around this, but I had experienced it in the church. I'd experienced questioning, what does it mean to be a woman who wants to go to graduate school, who wants to be involved in leadership? What does that mean for me? And I felt lost. And so when I found out there were not only researchers, but quite frankly, there were female researchers who were asking these questions, pretty immediately I was sold. I thought, I want to be in that group and I want to be doing research about these issues. I didn't even know we were allowed to do that. And I knew they only took kind of a couple people a year. And that's why I pretty immediately I was like, I want one of those spots. This is so cool. I want to do this.
Totally. Yeah. And then from there, if I remember correctly, you chose your dissertation, your master's thesis and dissertation topics, looking at some differences between complementarian, egalitarian. I know that it's more complicated than that, but some of those broad themes, some of those broad categories. Can you talk a little bit about how you formulated your research topics and sort of what kinds of phenomena you looked at in those research projects?
Yes. So when I first met with she wasn't my advisor yet, but she's who I wanted to be my advisor. Her name was Liz Hall. I met with her and I sort of had this extravagant plan. I said, I want to look at, I know, I had like 10 variables. I was like, I want to look at purity culture and I want to prove that that's sexist. And I want to look at that. I had just all these ideas. And I remember she said, you know what, let's go ahead and pick one or two, but let's slow down a little bit.
Yeah.
And so that is when I became super interested in the idea of benevolent sexism. And I think it's probably important at this point to define what that is, because I always think that probably sounds like such an oxymoron. So whenever I tell people I study benevolent sexism, they're like, benevolent sexism. And I'm like, I know, let me explain. So benevolent sexism is sort of a branch that falls under the umbrella of a theory called ambivalent sexism. Two predominant researchers, Peter Glick and Susan Fisk were their names. They came up with this theory because they thought about how sexism is a little bit different than other more traditional models of discrimination, because it has both positive and negative views about women as a part of it, instead of just negative views, mm-hmm. which is why they came up with this idea of ambivalent sexism. So within that, benevolent sexism is sort of the happy side of sexism. It's the side that says, no, we don't hate women. We want to protect them. We want to cherish them. Women are so special. They're so pure. We need to really make sure that they're on a pedestal and they are special and taken care of. And so it's the side of sexism that's less about, because there is the other side. The other side is hostile sexism. And this is the idea that like women are conniving, they're manipulative, men have to have power over them in order to keep peace in the society. But the benevolent side is far more elusive. It's this idea that, again, that women complete men. They are, they're weaker and fragile, so they need to be protected because we love them. Mm-hmm. And so this is an idea. If you think about it, you think like chivalry. Women need to have the door open for them, and we need to hold bags for them, and we need to pay for them. And so this is the side that's pretty aligned with, as you mentioned before, issues in the evangelical culture, or stances in the evangelical culture about things like complementarianism and egalitarianism. Mm-hmm. So complementarianism is that theological view that men and women are both equal in the eyes of God, but they should hold complementary roles. They're inherently different. And so that's why they complement each other. And the difference is that women should be holding the more maternal, caretaking roles, whereas men should be holding the leadership, power, thinking roles. I think that many people I know who identify as complementarian would say those are inherently equal in the eyes of God, but that there is sort of our essence as, again, as I'm a female, I identify with she, her pronouns, that they would say I inherently then have roles given by God that would only fit the part that has to do with caretaking, nurturing, things like that. Mm-hmm. So that is definitely the area I got interested in, because I think for me, and this is why this relationship is kind of close to my heart, is that from an early age, I felt like I had kind of leadership qualities or potentials. And I started directing children's musicals when I was like 13. I basically could have still been in them. And in the church growing up, I definitely found myself wanting to be in these more leadership positions. And at a certain point, it was so clear there was sort of like a line in the sand of like, mm-hmm. you can work with children, maybe, but like leadership wise, like that's it. And it felt so confusing. So mm-hmm.
yeah, this is the ceiling and you can't go above that.
Yes, mm-hmm. definitely.
Yeah. There's one more term I want you to define. You mentioned purity sure. culture. Can you talk a little mm-hmm. bit about what that is? Because some people, you know, might've grown up in it, but not necessarily right. know that term.
You know, it's interesting. So benevolent sexism, like I said, there's researchers I can cite. There's lots of research on it. So it's a little bit more of an easier term to define, because as far as being a psychologist, like this is research and things mm-hmm. I can point to.
Yeah, they have to define it.
Culture. Yes. Purity culture is more difficult because there's not been a ton of research on it because of the fact that we haven't totally defined it yet. But in general, purity culture is particularly usually within religious communities. I know the stuff that I study has been particularly the evangelical community. Mm-hmm. And it's about the idea that purity, sexual purity, abstinence, sex before marriage, is this very high stakes issue, particularly for women. Mm-hmm. And so this is sort of in your early middle school age time, in which there begins to be a lot of conversations, particularly geared towards women, about things like, don't make your brother stumble. So you need to be wearing particular clothes because you are the gatekeeper for sexuality. So if something happens sexually that's impure, the fault tends to be put on the woman because this idea that men, I'm getting in the weeds a little early here, but this idea that again, the whole conversation about sex in the evangelical community, the purity and staying abstinent is so important, and all the messages about men and women that go into that. I know that's not a great definition, but it's a pretty complicated and broad umbrella.
Yeah, I think it helps to set the context at least. You know, I've heard it a lot within evangelical or within the context of evangelical churches, but you know, I think the definition you gave could even apply to perhaps, I'm not super familiar, but maybe Islamic cultures where there's a certain expectation that's put on women in terms of sexual purity.
Yes, definitely. And I think maybe like one other piece that's so important is just this idea that men are sexual to the point where they can't be held accountable and women are not. Mm-hmm. And so that the onus and the reason why purity culture is so often targeted at women is because the onus of sexual purity is on women. Mm-hmm. Men can't be held accountable to it. There's again, this sort of subtle ideology that men are so sexual that they wouldn't be able to help it. And women are not. So they are the ones who have to be careful. They have to be the ones who cover up, who are the ones who say no, who keep themselves pure, which is why then purity becomes so much more important for women, at least in part.
Totally. Yeah. So when we talk about gender roles in society and starting to unpack some of these topics, you know, both of us come from Christian backgrounds, but I feel like a lot of it is also just in the general pop culture. You know, there's the Me Too movement. There's a lot of different ways in which things of this nature have permeated the zeitgeist, the talk of today. Can you talk a little bit about what are some of the similarities and differences you see among perhaps maybe more Christian versus more secular views on what gender roles are? And I particularly am asking this question because I feel like in some ways, and maybe this is just my own bias as being in the field of psychology, but I feel like in a lot of ways, there has been a lot of change over time in terms of what gender roles mean. And I think that churches often can come down on one side or the other of, you know, we're going to be more traditional or we're going to be more progressive. So can you talk a little bit about some of those similarities and differences that you see?
Yeah. So one thing I think about, maybe another distinction to make here is that when we're talking about gender roles is both sort of a part of benevolent sexism, and it's also sort of the outcome of benevolent sexism. So the way that I've made sense of it, even though this is such a like silly distinction, but it's been confusing to me, is benevolent sexism is the ideology. It's about who we are kind of inherently and what makes sense. And then gender roles, either sort of more traditional gender roles that fits that more complementarian frame or more egalitarian gender roles, which fits a more, you take up the roles that make the most sense for who you are. There isn't a prescription. It has to do with more of like, it's just the prescription of, it is the rules. It is the structure in which to follow that kind of is birthed from benevolent sexism. But again, I think what feels complicated about that is that in theory, at least along the lines of how psychology has defined benevolent sexism, then more traditional or complementarian roles would fall more within that benevolently sexist ideology. Whereas egalitarianism, if we're kind of thinking about this on a spectrum, is on the other end. And I think just like you said, there's been sort of a movement in society, and in fact, research would follow this in both religious and secular communities. We're moving towards a more egalitarian model. And especially in more of like a secular community, there's been a ton of pushback about this, that women should be allowed to work and that we should be thinking about parenting from a much more egalitarian perspective, that these roles of mother and caretaker should be equally divided. I guess not mother, father, parent, and caretaker should be equally divided among parents and households. And so I think we're moving in that direction. I think what ends up happening though, is that in religious communities, because of particular verses in the Bible, we see this sort of backlash or sort of movement against that like this is the worldly movement and we as the church need to sort of be standing firm in God's word and we need to stick with the sort of divine intention of man and woman and marriage. Mm-hmm. And so there sort of seems to be, in many churches that I've seen and been a part of, a tendency to want to hold on to this sort of biblical framework for marriage. I'm doing quotes here. I know this is a podcast, so you can't see. Biblical framework for marriage, because I think that's complicated and nuanced on its own. Mm-hmm. But that there's a movement away from that, and a real want to hold to two-person female male marriage, to hold those roles, man as leader. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes you hear the phrase servant leader, mm-hmm. And woman as kind of submissive wife. So, you know, I think in many ways, what's interesting is that this is the ideology, but actually there's also been research to show that for many, even complementarian or more traditional gender roled families, they're still splitting up the work in a more egalitarian way because of the fact that this is how our society often works. It's actually practical. Just much more uncommon. Mm-hmm. Yes, to like have a family in which those specifically, like, let me give you an example. So in theory, things like major purchases would fall within the husband or male's purview. Mm-hmm. And yet most families, husband and wife, even in a more complementarian framework, are going to have those discussions together. Should we buy a car? I don't know. Let's mm-hmm. think about it. It's Christmas time, so I'm thinking about all those commercials in which a man just buys his wife a car, and it's like, that's so unrealistic. We need to talk about those things.
Yeah, that doesn't
And
happen.
So the reality is, right, that way of thinking where it's like, as a husband and wife, we're going to think about that and our finances and our future. That's a pretty egalitarian in practice way of doing things. Mm-hmm. And I just think that it's actually less common to see people even who hold those views. I guess what I'm trying to say is it feels more in theory. In mm-hmm. theory, if we came to a point where we couldn't agree as a couple, then the man would get to have that decision-making power mm-hmm. and that leadership role. But in reality, many couples are who fall under that are still making those decisions. So I don't know if I'm answering your question much, but I think it's messy. Mm-hmm. That's my answer.
Totally.
I think it's super messy. And I think that both in secular culture and in Christian culture and the Christian world, this is something people are still trying to make sense of cognitively. But the reality is, I think we're all moving more egalitarian. Yeah.
Well, I think you're pointing out a couple of things. You know, one, that you can try to stick to the letter of the law, but in practice, things rarely work out that way. And so what really we're debating or what really we're trying to unpack is perhaps what complementarians mean when they mean gender roles or these sort of complementary roles, and what egalitarians mean when they mean sort of equality or other sort of things that maybe they still, you know, have some things that complementarians would point to and say, hey, see, this is why, you know, this works out this way, that it's not so black and white. It's not so clear cut of, you know, you're in this camp or you're in that camp, and that's what that means.
I completely agree. And I think as a professor, as a psychologist, as a thinker, as a person, as a Christian, one of my goals, and I have to remind myself of this so often, is that I want to be nuanced. I want to be seeking God's truth. I want to be inclusive, which to me means people from both sides of any sort of debate. Mm-hmm. And I find that that's where, for so many of these conversations, my mind goes. Is that I think we are so much more similar than we are different. We when we really get into the weeds of it, our lives, what things look like, we all tend to have more similarities in our struggles and what we're dealing with in our marriages than not.
Totally.
And so I think, I remember as a small anecdote, when I was teaching psychology of gender at Biola, and I introduced them to this term feminism, but the idea of feminism, because I think especially in the Christian world, that can have a ton of baggage that goes along with it. Mm-hmm. And at some point, it was scandalous in my experience, but down the line in class, we're talking about complementarian egalitarianism, and I was leading a discussion, but I wasn't really like letting them know what I was thinking. And I had a student point blank ask me, can you be feminist and complementarian at the same time? And I just remember my mind being just like blown. And I was like, I don't know how to answer that. I was like, if this idea of feminism is kind of total equality and complementarianism doesn't seem to hold that, how can that? And I just remember being, and she looked so earnest, like, you know, I think learning about feminism and also wanting to hold complementarianism, she wanted to have both and just feeling so confused by that. And I think kind of back to your question, that's this idea is like, how can we as a society be moving forward towards egalitarianism? And I think Christians get, especially who want to hold to a more traditional view, it's like, how can we make sense of that in the world that we live in? Mm-hmm. And that's where things can get messy.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but, you know, that's sort of where you get these, it seems like binary options where either it's like, mm-hmm. world is all bad, we have to completely cut ourselves off from that, or right. you know, what can be called, you know, quote unquote syncretistic, where it's like we're just adopting and we're not being critical of what's truth mm-hmm. or what's God's truth and things like that. So yeah, mm-hmm. you, as we're both alluding to, it can get very messy. But before we mm-hmm. go there, I want to back up a little bit and sure. hear a little bit of your own story. What were some of the messages that you got growing up about being a woman, being a sexual being, mm-hmm. being a Christian woman? You know, what were some of those messages that you received, and how did that impact the way that you thought growing up?
So I think we could spend the rest of the podcast just on that. So I will try to be sure. succinct. I'll try to come up with a few of the most kind of clear examples. Mm-hmm. But I grew up going to church sporadically with my family. It wasn't until I got to middle school that I ended up getting involved with a church where I got very involved with their youth group and with the church in general. This church happened to be a part of the Southern Baptist Convention, but in general was a more conservative ideological church than I had been going to for most of my life, and also was different than sort of the general sort of ideology in my family, which I think is an important distinction before I hop into some of this. So this was kind of unique to my experience at church.
Okay.
So especially right in that middle school, high school time. So pretty immediately I really got connected, and I think I had a lot of energy to be helping. So almost immediately I got involved in helping with Vacation Bible School. That led me to being a part of the children's ministry. And again, I'm young, I'm in middle school, but I was kind of co-teaching the preschool Bible study on Sundays. And as I got into kind of high school, it just started to progress. Again, I got interested in children's musicals, and I had been in children's musicals when I was a kid, and I thought it'd be really nice for our church to have this. So I actually developed a program and directed, and without any other sort of like adult supervision, I created this program, and we did a spring and a Easter and a Christmas musical every year for about 6 years. Mm-hmm. And really just started to take off and really wanted to become sort of a leader. And I found so much energy, and I was in the worship team on Sundays. And at a certain point, my pastor sat me down and he said, "I'm worried about you, Carrie." And I remember specifically the phrase he used that will never, I think this will be burned into my memory for the rest of my life. He said he was worried about my female sin nature. And he made a very specific sort of, it wasn't just about my sin nature as a person and as Carrie, but my female sin nature, which he defined for me as the fact that all women have a particular sin nature that is to kind of usurp men's power. And that this will be something all women will have to work on quelling. Wow. And that this is something that is a particular struggle that women will have. Mm-hmm. And that he could already tell that being submissive and quiet were two things that I was already going to be struggling with. And so this was, I must have been 14 or 15 at the time that we had this mm-hmm. this one-on-one.
Yeah.
And it was so disorienting to me. And I felt very confused because mm-hmm. I remember thinking, so what does that mean for me? Like, does that mean I shouldn't keep leading the children's musicals? Like the actual, as a 15-year-old, I remember thinking, I'm in trouble. What do I do differently? What's my next step to not be in trouble anymore? Yeah, yeah. And these ideas of being submissive and passive, I was like, but I'm not going against what someone's saying. Like this idea of being submissive or non-submissive meant to me that I was being sort of ornery or I was moving away from something. And it was so untangible to me. So for a few years, I remember just trying to figure out, what do I do to not be in trouble? I was like, what's the right way to be a woman in the church? And this is where ideas, I remember seeking out other women and asking, what does that mean? And a big one was be slow to speak. That was like a big sort of like idea, slow to speak, kind of be just a little quieter, as you know, Gabriel. Mm-hmm. I'm not the quietest person you've probably ever met, but early on, they were like,
that adjective to describe you.
Yeah, no, I don't think many people would. They talk a little less, be a little quieter, and really, again, take sort of a backseat approach. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that is, it didn't feel congruent with who I was. That was one of the first major messages. And I think that really spoke more to the idea of leadership. Then there was all the messages about sexuality. And I was one of the people who, I think there are many, many young women probably around my age who were part of the evangelical culture who got similar messages. We got this, we got some sort of message at some point about being some sort of object. Let me be more clear. So on some sort of retreat, I was taken with the other women and we were sat down, and I was probably right around that same age, probably 15, 16 years old. We were told, and it was a man giving me this lecture too, which kind of makes me want to eye roll now, but he pulled out a peach and he said, "You're a peach." And he said, every time you have any sort of like sexual encounter or you go too far with a boy, it's like getting a bruise in your peach. And he would like push on it. He would like put a little bruise on it. And he'd be like, and you know, at the end of the day, when you want to get married, like, is anyone really going to want to buy a bruised peach? And it's so interesting because the more I've delved into this topic, there are iterations on iterations of that story. Mm-hmm. There's the tape, where the tape that will lose its stickiness. There's the rose that's passed around the whole audience until it's broken and all the petals have fallen off. And there's the one with the present that's been unwrapped or the baby doll that's been used. I mean, there are a terrifying amount of iterations of that story that women have heard. And what's interesting is I've only heard that women have heard it. It is a uniquely female story to give. And this idea that there are so many things I really, truly do not like about that message. One is that you are an object. Two is that the purpose of your objectivity will be taken away if you have sex. Mm-hmm. That you will be damaged goods and nobody will want you. Mm-hmm. And that, in fact, again, your entire personhood is then wound up in your sexuality. I mean, the criticalness of it, the urgency of it, you could not let this one thing go. Mm-hmm. And that was one of those ones, again, that I felt very confused by and I felt very fearful of. And again, there's so much more we think about that too, because then when you get married, you're supposed to just be like, now this is not bad. This thing that could damage my personhood is now a beautiful gift from God, which is like a flip that can't be switched like that. And you're taught that this thing damages who you are. So yeah. I think between those two stories, there's, like I said, there's so much more, but those were some of the main messages I got, was that purity was everything to who you are as a woman, and also like kind of take a backseat, submissive.
Object sort of analogy that you used brings us right back to benevolent sexism, that women are these either fragile or vulnerable people, or, you know, objects, let's just call it what it is, that need to be protected. And so even if you don't necessarily think of yourself as a sexist, the disposition that you might have towards a woman might come out of some of these ideas, and you might treat a woman differently than you would a man because of what you think she is vulnerable or not vulnerable to.
Right.
So when did you become, well, you told me a little bit about when you became aware of the term benevolent sexism, when you started to dig into it and unpack it a little bit more? Was it like this light bulb that went off for you of like, oh my gosh, like this is what happened? Or did it take some time to really sort of pull the pieces together? Like, how did you sort of connect benevolent sexism to your own stories and experiences?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was certainly more like a light bulb. I remember reading, so the survey, so of course in developing my dissertation, I needed to pick measures to measure this construct. So the main one to measure benevolent sexism, it's called the Ambivalent Sexism Inventory, and they have a whole subsection for benevolent sexist questions. Read through those, and I thought, oh, this is it. These are the things. Like, I was like, wow. And I went as far as to, I read those questions to a member of my church growing up. And again, I'm in graduate school at this point, so I've sort of moved away from home. Uh-huh. But I went, when I was home one time, I read them to a particular person too, who I knew would be passionately complementarian. I read those. And he was like, yes, true. Yes, 5 out of 5. And was going through them. And I said, I ended it, and I said, that is a questionnaire on sexism. And he said, if that's a questionnaire on sexism, then I am sexist. Those are views I completely stand by. So it was sort of like a moment too of like, okay, I'm not crazy. That is in fact what I was taught. This is what I was taught. This highly validated measure on sexism. Someone who was very close in my life completely agreed with. This is what I was taught. But I think even more than that, one of the things about benevolent sexism I just find really complicated, or the thing that struck in me was, well, then what's the right answer? What is the other thing we should be doing? Mm-hmm. And I can give you an example of this that I think is probably the most complicated one given our current society still. And that's dating. So, okay, you think about it, right? And you know, let me back this up with some facts here. So all the research we have on benevolent sexism, which there's been quite a bit, and including true experiments. So true experiments, of course, mean that we can use causal language. We can talk about the fact that it was, in fact, exposure to benevolent sexism that led to these kind of poor outcomes.
Yeah, and these poor outcomes sort of control.
And these, let me give you like a classic experiment that's out there. Women and men are in a waiting room waiting to go in to do a study on what they think is going to just be like mathematics skills. And as they're waiting to be called to go be a participant in the study, they're in the lobby and a woman is walking through with a box, a heavy box. And she looks at one of the female participants and says, hey, will you help me with this box? And there's two conditions in this experiment. One, the woman is allowed to get up and help the woman with the box. Two, a man jumps up and says, oh, no, I'll get it. Let me, and helps the woman with the box. This seems like a relatively benign difference, right? In fact, one you can easily imagine happening. However, the women in the condition in which a man jumped up and helped, they went on to perform worse in math. They would go into like these interviews where they were supposed to be selling themselves for a job. And the women who had that condition were more likely to talk about their relational qualities and their competence. They went on to objectify their bodies more. I mean, there's been study after study that shows that exposure to benevolent sexism is not good for women. Mm-hmm. It actually leads to a ton of negative outcomes for women. Okay, so we know this. And I think about this because I would teach my students this. Now I've taught you about it, Gabriel. Now we know this. So what do we do with this knowledge? Mm-hmm. Now let's take it to the dating world. You are a guy and you're taking a girl out for a date. And now you're all aware. You know, benevolent sexism, treating women weaker, seeing them as needing to be taken care of is not good for them. Even being mildly exposed to it's not good for them. Mm-hmm. Do you pay? Do you hold the door open for them? Do you care? Mm-hmm. Help them with something heavy if they have it? There's all these questions in my mind where oftentimes it's like, we still live in a world where that's expected, where that's normal, where in fact, if you think about dating, like, of course, like if you like the person, you want to go on another date with them, it could lead to no more dates if you don't pay as a guy. That could be construed as rude. So I think we're still just in a place where what we do with this information feels really, I think, difficult. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I think about is how I think then the onus is on women and men too. But I think especially like, so I'm married. I don't think I've shared this podcast. I'm married, been married for about 7 years. I'm a pretty able-bodied person, can do things just fine for myself for the most part. But I still, if my husband wants to carry a suitcase for me up a stairs, will I let him? Will I even ask him? Sometimes. Like there are things that I do that I still play into it. Mm-hmm. And I still sort of like, I'm like, oh, well, I could not do this right now. Yeah. Someone could help me with this right now. Mm-hmm. And I think, I think that's the complexity is now that we have this information, both as men and women, what do we do with it? And what's at stake then if we do or don't sort of keep playing into this system?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think this brings up a good point to emphasize is that, this isn't a conversation of pointing fingers at, oh, you're sexist or you're sexist. It's, I think, just like any other ism that's out there, whether it's racism or ableism or whatever it is, that this isn't about pointing fingers. This is about understanding all of our roles to play in this. And for me as a guy, understanding how to overcome my own inherent sexism, that this is just something that we have been exposed to within society. And whether you like it or not, these are ideas that we all sort of share in some form or another. And like you pointed out, it's not just about not being sexist. It's about understanding the big picture so that you can make these decisions of, okay, well, what do I do? Do I pay for the date? Do I open the door? It could depend, depending on who you're with and what their views are. And so that, you know, going back to the title of this podcast, these are hard questions without any real clear answers, that take some wrestling and take some intentional thought to sort of deal with. So I want to make that point clear that this isn't about debating who's right or who's wrong. It's about understanding that there are a lot of factors at play, and benevolent sexism being one of them. How do we put some language to that so we can actually make an informed decision?
And when I thought about your podcast and why I chose this, because I think in many ways, benevolent sexism doesn't feel like a too difficult answer for me to come to, which is that it's not good. The research I have done and the research I have read, kind of the jury has made a conclusion, it's not good. But this is where I find it to be incredibly confusing. And this is actually probably spanning all the different topics that I think about and care about around gender issues, which is the idea, though, that what does that mean for the church when so many people in the church will go back to these sort of pillar verses? You know, I'm thinking about 1 Timothy 2. Mm-hmm. Women should learn in quiet and full submissiveness. I do not permit a woman to teach or assume authority. That is in the Bible, right? So, as Gabriel will know, we wrote full papers in graduate school, full exegetical papers, digging through verses, and I happened to do this one. So there's a lot I could say about that verse, and there's a stance that I can have about it. But there's plenty of people who have a different stance on that verse that would say, yes, this is why we need to follow a complementarian ideology, and it doesn't matter what research you've done. It doesn't matter that there's research that shows that this is not what the Bible says. And that's it. And so then I find that, like, finding ways to have open doors to have conversations about that and what that means. Because my big question is, and this is one of the first things I did in my master's thesis, was people who hold a more egalitarian ideology are flourishing more. It's more correlated with flourishing than a complementarian ideology is. And I actually used a variable. We said no jargon, but terrible name, eudaimonic well-being, which was this idea of when we're thinking about well-being, it's not just sort of the more pleasure or happiness side, what feels better. This was a variable that looked more at what gives you meaning, what sort of filling your life with purpose. Mm-hmm. And people who were egalitarian, women who were egalitarian, there was a stronger correlation between being egalitarian and that type of well-being. And especially when we kind of dug into it even further, the subscale of that well-being measure that was driving that relationship had to do with fulfilling your potential. And when I think about that as a Christian, I think about my God-given gifts and being able to actually live those out and, like, do those in real time and be able to fulfill those. And many philosophers, psychologists, people think about this, would say that is how you sort of move towards self-actualization, is being able to sort of live out your potentials and the things that give you meaning and purpose. And to me, that's what feels like such at stake, is that this is not just a matter of what makes you happy or not, because I think easily you could say the Bible kind of trumps that, and that is what it is. But if what we're finding through psychology, which many would argue, what we find in research is also God's truth, right? What we learned through our natural sciences, all truth is God's truth. What we're finding is that women, and then subsequently what I found with men as well, are not flourishing as greatly, or it's not related to as higher levels of flourishing when they hold these more traditional views. If you think about it, right? If as a man, you are allowed half, these are the half of the roles you're allowed to take up. And as a woman, I get those other half. Mm-hmm. And if you have some of those on the other side, then you just don't get to live those out. Mm-hmm. You need to kind of hide those away. Yeah. Then you are not living up to your full potential. And that can really, I think, over time, really eat away at, like, your soul. Mm-hmm. So I think there's actually a lot at stake that I wish we could have more conversations like this, where we're opening the door, where it's like, there's not, like, a right answer, but, like, what can we do so that people can sort of be living out the best of themselves?
Yeah. Yeah. And I definitely resonate with a lot of what you said in terms of what feels like it's at stake, you know, from our perspective, especially coming from being psychologically trained. I do want to sort of go on the other side too of what perhaps people who hold more traditional or more complementary views feel like is at stake for them is perhaps a sense of either a biblical truth of this is the way God intended it, or this is the way that God set it up in the beginning. There might be a threat in terms of what is viewed as orderly or authoritative, that there are certain ways in which this narrative is supposed to be played out. Right. I think of also, you know, husbands love your wives as Christ loved the church, that there is this script that we're supposed to play, that it's almost like, you know, you play your part and I'll play my part. And if that gets thrown out of balance, then are we living as married couples the way that God intended us to, or are we fulfilling our role as we're intended to? So how have you, and I'm sure that you've come across far more discussions about this than I have, how have you sort of grappled with some of these very difficult conversations where there are these different values at stake, these different viewpoints?
First, before I really answer your question, I'll start by just saying that wrestling is the right word. I think my journey in regards to not just benevolent sexism, but also thinking about issues of purity culture, thinking about LGBT issues, thinking about a lot of these issues surrounding gender and sexuality in the church, is that I'm constantly worried I'm doing it wrong. I remember one time I sat in my car and I just cried for like a while in prayer about like, if I'm on the wrong track here, like if I'm leading people astray into a life that's not flourishing, like, let me know, God. I need to know. And I think part of my conviction as a researcher, and again, just as a person, as a Christian, as a thinker, is that I can't wait to be 100% certain. I can't wait till I have the phone call from God where he's like, you're on track. Good job. to be aware of what I think God has put in my heart and what I felt like. At every turn, I feel like doors have continued to open and be thinking about these things. I think with everything I talk about in these things, I try to make sure it's clear that I don't feel a level of certainty that I wish I could, but I actually think that is so important. I think certainty is mostly a myth or a, what's the right word? It's like something we make up to cling to find some comfort, but in reality, I think sitting in, and that's why, Gabe, I love your podcast, because I think for me in my life, that's so important to me, that we sit in the uncertainty and the messiness of it. And I think choosing to go into how the Christian community walks through gender issues is like, so it's a thing I do now, is sit in the messiness of it. So
totally.
Because I think, you know, as I've talked with people on either side of the coin, especially again, people who are pulling out these Bible verses and these thoughts, it can be quite compelling. You know, I think in 1 Timothy, one of the most difficult ones for me was, it says, for Adam was formed first, then Eve. And there's all this stuff in Genesis too about how there's this importance about the fact that Adam was created first and Eve was created from Adam. And you know, many people translate parts of Genesis as calling Eve his helper. But there's also been lots of research and thinkers, and again, people translating from the Greek and Latin to help understand that in many ways, that seems like a mistranslation. You know, the phrase I'm thinking of is Ezer Kenegdo, and many people translate that as helper. But when really digging into it, people have learned that because of other places in which God is referred to by that same language, that what this really means is sustainer beside me. And that there's actually, again, countless ways. When I dug into 1 Timothy in that exegetical paper I did, I learned all sorts of things about the time period in which that verse was written, about the community of women, particularly in that time period, where many of them had just sort of transitioned out of the sex cult, and that many women were sort of like unruly in this church. There was so much that I learned. And honestly, that did sort of freak me out. Because this is like 3 or 4 verses. We spent an entire semester. I just like read massive books on. I thought you could do this for every verse in the Bible. I don't think there's time to do this for every verse in the Bible. But I think in general, like for me, it's been about like digging into things, reading about what other thinkers have been thinking about it. And really also just like in prayer, like learning about like I think God is leading me in this direction, especially towards like more leadership positions. How do I reconcile that? How do I make sense of that? And then coming back to me with this idea of like, this is what leads to me feeling a sense of purpose in my life and feeling like I'm living out my potential, and that feels congruent with both my spiritual life and what I know about psychology. I don't know that I'm answering your question now that I'm thinking about it.
I think what I really appreciate about what you just said, and I think this is something I appreciate about you in general, is, you know, not just the content and the work that you've done, but the disposition and the posture that you bring when you approach conversations like this. And, you know, I think with any academic endeavor, there's going to be multiple perspectives, even aside from differing religious views or biblical interpretations. And what I so appreciate about what you bring to this discussion is that you want to do your research with integrity. And it's not just about getting the right answer, but also about trying to help people live a flourishing life, regardless of whether or not they agree with you theologically.
Yeah, I think about this a lot. I mean, and I'm not a theologian. That's not what I studied, you know, in depth or got a degree in. But when I think about this idea a lot that the Bible, let me say this differently, the culture in which the Bible was written wasn't a sanctified or holy culture in and of itself, you know, and that like so many of the things in which the writers of the time of the Bible were having to think about were culturally laden to that time period. And I think there's just such a complexity in trying to take and understand and learn what God intended us to learn from these stories and these verses and these experiences that are written in the Bible. And I think it is a noble and okay pursuit to be trying to figure out what that means for our lives today and what it looks like then. And I think holding in mind this question, like you just said, of like, what will lead to a life that is flourishing, that I think that is what God intends us to live, a life that is that's meaningful and produces value and purpose for people. Like, how do we get to that? And I think, you know, we live in a society right now where there's just so much going on in the world of understanding how what our religious and across religions, what our religious beliefs mean for like our daily life and what we should believe, how we should vote, what we should be doing with our lives. And, you know, I think about how daunting and scary it can be to start to like say like, well, what about this other view, or how else can we be thinking about it? And yet when I see other people doing that, like recently Beth Moore, she's a pretty well-known evangelical Bible study leader and leader in general. She wrote some things on social media that I thought were pretty provocative and pretty, I thought people are going to have thoughts about that. And yet when I read it, what I read was that it took a lot of bravery and courage to start those conversations and to be challenging people. And so I hope, yeah, to find that balance in both like being true to the convictions that are in my heart and what I'm learning and what I'm studying, what I feel like I'm getting from my prayer time and my research and all of that together, and also being sort of inclusive and opening doors and starting conversations and building bridges rather than sort of dividing us more.
Yeah, and we live in this already not yet sort of limbo space where the church is inhabited by imperfect, messy people. Yes. Who make mistakes and don't get it right all the time. And so we need people who are willing to take the risk to call out blind spots and to try to help see things from different perspectives. And right. So, I think that's very important. I think another thing that is challenging about this topic is the developmental nature of these things that we're talking about. You mentioned in your own story how some of these very impactful ideas and some of those very formative experiences came when you were in middle school, and right. You know, probably even some before then. But you know, that's a time where adolescents are, you know, they're hitting puberty, they're trying to figure out themselves, they're trying to fit in with their friends, and parents are trying to figure out, how do I talk to my kids about things like this? And then we're adding on this whole other layer of social expectations and sexism and trying to treat each other with respect. And so there's just so many moving pieces that can make this conversation so challenging. And as your story demonstrates, misinformation can have such a detrimental effect as well. And so I think it can be paralyzing sometimes to try to figure out, you know, how do we have good conversations with adolescents, with younger individuals who want to know, what do I do with my body? How do I relate to other people? How do I develop a healthy view of sexuality? And so I'm curious, from your work, from your research, you know, how would you suggest that somebody approaches this topic?
You know, before I answer your question, yet again, I'm just going to think about the complexity of this, because I, you know, just like my dating quandary, where, you know, after I would teach about benevolent sexism to my students, I would say to my male students, I was like, I realize this is a situation that I'm thinking is mostly going to impact you, because now you have to decide, do I bring this up? Do I pay? Do I do all right? I think similarly, I think about parents and gender development often too. So I'm not a parent yet, but I can often imagine myself in this scenario. I would like to help my children be able to, from an early age, might be these hypothetical children of mine, develop a sense of their gender that is congruent to who they are, rather than prescriptive of things we don't even know about them, right? But they actually develop them into people, whole people that have to have been, and what they care about and who they are, right? The specialness that God made them. So, okay, I'm thinking about this. So let's say I have a little boy. Let's say I have a little boy and he loves pink and dolls, and he wants to get like a My Little Pony lunchbox to take to school with him. And because he loves horses or something like that. And he loves his pink box. So as a parent and who's kind of thinking about some of these things, I have two options, right? I'm sure there's more than two options, but here are two things that might run through my head.
Sure.
I want to instill in this child that it's perfectly okay to like pink and to like your lunchbox and to choose whatever's good for you. And I don't want to say, well, you know, little boys don't like pink and they shouldn't like My Little Pony. Let's get you a Power Rangers lunchbox, right? Because that is the early stuff that begins to say to little boys and little girls, okay, this is what's okay for me and this is what's not. Okay. So there's that side of the fence. But then there's this other side that I might be thinking about. And I might be thinking, I don't want my kid to get bullied. I don't want my kid to get made fun of. I don't want them to show up with the My Little Pony box and something bad happened to them. Like, again, they can't sit with their friends or someone's mean to them. And I think the society we live in is changing for the better in this way, where that's not happening nearly as much. But those are still thoughts and ideas that would be so understandable to have run their parents' head. To which then they might say, no, let's choose a different one for you, which is still sending this message of, this is not okay for you as a little boy. And again, you have the flip side for girls as well. So I think that as far as, in my mind, the parenting aspect of this, where you begin to be shapers of helping your children know, not just in regards to gender, but in regards to all sorts of things, this is okay and this is not okay for you. This is inherently complicated, because I think for the most part, parents really care about their kids and they want to set them up to have a life that feels good. So I think holding both of those in mind as parents, this idea of like, what's going to help them flourish, as far as what we know so far, is to let them build an identity that's not prescriptive, but is actually exploratory in who they are. And how can we do that in a way that continues to promote sort of letting people learn about themselves? And that's sort of like on the child side. When we get into like the teenage years and the puberty and sexuality, I think it's also pretty complicated, because, you know, I've thought about this a lot. I think about these hypothetical children of mine, probably more than one should, but I think about, I was like, well, how will I talk to my kids about sex? Will I encourage them to be abstinent? Even though we know, again, based on research, that abstinence-only education is not at all a deterrent from having sex, and in fact leads to more poorer sex outcomes in teenagers, like pregnancies, STDs, because most of the time they haven't learned about things like condoms or birth control, right? Okay, so will I talk to them about abstinence? Will I then teach them about the other stuff? Is that condoning it? Like, there's just all these confusions in my head about like this idea of like, then what is the right answer? But again, I think what I've stumbled upon, and maybe when I become a parent someday and I do all this for real, it'll look totally different.
Yeah.
But I'd like to think that, especially for any daughters I might have or young women I might end up being in this sort of role with, is to help them know that A, you are sexual, you and the men, you're going to be sexual. This is a part of how God created us. This is a part of who we are, and learning about what that means about you. And that's a part of you. It's a good part of you. It's a healthy, normal human part of you. And how do you manage that in a way that feels good to you, that's in line with your values, helping them think about what would be important to them. And so if that's important to you, how do you live in line with that? How do you find ways to manage then sexual urges and other things that are going to come up in your life that are normal and healthy? And to me, that'll be all the messiness, like what that'll actually look like, I can't even think about. But the idea that those parts of you, those feelings that you will develop, urges you will have that can feel so confusing, are healthy, normal, okay parts of you. It will be learning how to manage those in a way that feels good to you in whatever beliefs you have, but that those are okay parts of you. Because I think that's what feels so dangerous. And in my reading about the purity culture, even though there's not a lot of research on it, there is tons of anecdotal blogs and articles and even books about women's experience, is this idea that that part of you, because you're taught you're not actually sexual. So what happens when you feel sexual? You're like, I'm deviant. I'm disgusting. I am so broken that I feel sexually attracted and I have urges. And what do I do with that as a woman? Because I'm not even supposed to have that really, or that's not, no one's ever talked to me about. What do I do if I feel like I want to watch pornography or I get addicted to pornography? There's lots of, I shouldn't say lots of, in my experience, there was room for guys to be having those conversations, but the conversations for the women were not about what do you do with any of your sexuality. It was about how do you protect the boys? How do you protect your brothers in Christ? Yeah. And so for me, it would be a lot about like helping them realize that this is, again, a normal, healthy, God-given part of your identity. And there'll be different times in which you'll be able to live that out. So how do you do that and manage that well?
Yeah, yeah. And I think what's tricky and different about this area of diversity as opposed to other areas of diversity is that we are all interacting with this all the time in real time. You know, for example, as opposed to race or ethnicity, where depending on where you live, who you decide to surround yourself with, you might have more or less engagement with people from different backgrounds. You know, for gender and sex, we are constantly interacting with people either of the same gender or sex, or and people of different gender and sex, and so. It's just, it feels like there's just constantly all these moving pieces. And all of us are trying to, I believe that all of us as human beings are trying to do our best. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, there can be, as we've discussed, all these mixed messages for no fault of anybody. You know, for example, guys might be feeling like, hey, this woman wants me to treat me this way, and then I'm getting a completely different message and a completely different expectation from this other woman. And same for women, as we discussed, you know, there might be a certain pressure that women feel to conform to a certain ideology, but what if they don't hold to that, or what if they have a different mm-hmm. perspective? And so I'm curious what your thoughts are with, you know, this attempt, this effort to try to be better for each other, to try to treat each other with respect, where at the same time there are all these different moving pieces of people having different opinions, different stages of their own identity, different developmental levels of how much they've engaged with this topic, or, you know, maybe this mm-hmm. is a completely new thing for them. I'm curious what your thoughts are about that.
Such a good question, because I think about this a lot. So one thing maybe on my mind as you asked that question was the idea of, especially for women, but for men and many times too, there's questions about what's appropriate then about expressing your sexuality, mm-hmm. right? And this is all, again, then ties back to purity culture issues and this sort of idea that women should be more modest. You know, I'm sure many of us have heard the old adage, modest is hottest, right? And that this is sort of this kind of hiding of your sexuality as to not make your brother stumble, yada, yada, yada. But a lot of times what it often does is it treats women like an object. And in fact, a threatening object, which is pretty scary that your body could be threatening. You know, I thought about this a lot. You know, we used to go backpacking every summer as a youth group for like 8 summers in a row. And this was all during like my pubertal years. I think I went from like when I was 12 to when I was 20. Mm-hmm. So I remember at one point it stopped being okay for me to just wear a sports bra when we'd like go swimming in the lakes. And there was a certain point where like, I need to start wearing t-shirts over my bathing suits at like youth group events. And there was all these things that I've talked to about that was like, all of a sudden my body became a little bit more dangerous and a little bit more threatening, and it needed to be hidden. And there was all this stuff about my sexuality and about like my developing body that just felt so scary to me. And then it felt like you scared other people, and it just became very confusing. And we weren't talking about it that much besides when we were getting scolded. And so when I watch things like recently, Shakira and J-Lo did the halftime show last year for Super Bowl. And I watched it with this sort of reverent awe of watching these women dance. Especially there was so much about like the cultures in which they came from that they interwove into their performance. And I watched it with such a sense of like awe and beauty. And I loved it. I mean, I just sat there just like, look at these women dancing and just like again, expressing themselves through their body in such an amazing way. Then I feel like I got a bunch of like people who were also watching with me who the look on their faces and in fact, some of the things they were saying afterwards reflected disgust. And I just remember thinking, I wouldn't say I was confused because I knew what was happening, but I was more just taken out of the mindset that I was in back into the fact that like people are looking at these women in very different ways than I was looking at them in this moment. And sort of like, mm-hmm. how do we
it's the same make Super sense Bowl of that? Show.
Yes. And again, actually the people I was with in that moment were mostly women. And in fact, they were straight women who I don't think they were looking at them in a sexual way for their own like pleasure desire, but like it was more of like a judgment, it felt like.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I thought one of these issues is just the idea that like we have both based on sort of secular ideology, but also this Christian purity culture ideology, we have objectified women's bodies in ways that I think restrict women from being able to like express themselves in the ways I think that can be really beautiful. However, I also wonder sort of like, what is the right answer? Where's the line in the sand? Have like a sexual ethic that's God pleasing. Because I think about this a lot, the idea of like, when I stand before God one day, will I be able to say, my body, my life, my marriage, my job, well, this was all for you. And so doing things in a way that's like God honoring. But if my body, which is the temple for Christ, is not God honoring just by existing, like that's gotta be a problem, right? So how do we sort of like create both a sexual ethic, a way to recognize and honor like our bodies as both sexual and also non-sexual? How do we sort of do this in a way that both does leave people feeling comfortable and we don't cause other people to stumble, but also put that onus on stumbling back on the people? Like when I go back to my Super Bowl anecdote, I think about the fact that it was through the lens and the eyes in which they were watching those women that was different, that I think was, how do I want to say this? It was the sexuality in their mind, what they were experiencing, that was the problem, because I was seeing it from a totally different lens. So where does the sin fall? If there was something sexually sinful going on in that moment, the women who were dancing are the people's eyesight and gaze in which they were watching it. So mm-hmm. I think in general, like a big thing I think about is we have to start sharing the responsibility of what goes on in our mind. Do you know what Jesus said? Jesus said, if you look at a woman lustfully, does he say, go snap at her and tell her to dress up? No, he says, snatch your eye out of your face. Yeah. He says, snatch your eye out of your head if it's causing you to stumble. I go back to that one all the time because I'm like, Jesus did not reprimand the hypothetical woman in that scenario. He said, get them eyes out of your face.
Yeah.
Come on. Like we have to hold on to that. But like, so I think so much of it is also learning how to like control our mind, be thinking about bodies differently, be thinking about sexuality differently. Mm-hmm. Again, not sure at all if I answered your question, but
yeah, I mean, it's a both and, And I think the part that gets neglected is sort of what you're pointing out to, is that, you know, you can sort of swing the pendulum so heavily to one side, where it's the onus only falls on the women, or the onus only falls on the men.
Yes.
Right. And this is a collective thing that we're trying to figure out together, that this is something where this is harming women in some way, this is harming men in some way.
Yes.
And if we don't figure this out, then both of us lose.
And I go back to this idea that something you said earlier that really rings true to me, which is like, there's no villains in this story. There is no like person who, in my mind, at least in my experience, did it out of malicious intent. Mm-hmm. Good intentions are thriving in this whole scenario, right? Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about the youth group leaders who sit down the boys and girls and start to help them try to think about this. I have not experienced and not met people who do that out of malicious intention. Mm-hmm. It's because they care about those kids and they want the best for them and they want them to live God-honoring lives, okay? Mm-hmm. So all this time of like saying, okay, men, you're going to see women's bodies and feel things and that's so scary. So don't watch porn and don't do anything and like try to hold it all in. And women, you got to hide your bodies. It just seems like it's all coming out of a place of good intention and love for these kids. But so often it's in the messaging that we're hearing, okay, for men, when I see women's bodies, there's nothing I'm able to do but see them as sexual. That's going to be terrible. Or women, you've got to hide your bodies. This is so, they're going to be so threatening. It's like, those are the messages that then begin to seep in, and then they impact how we see each other as men and as women. And so I think it's just going to be in a shifting of narrative, a shifting in conversation, and be thinking about what are the sort of the meanings behind what we're saying, even if they were coming out of love, which of course is a whole general conversation we're having, which is that these things that oftentimes are coming from very good intentions, which is why there is not like a, in my mind, like, someone to be like, you did it really wrong, or you're really bad for doing this. But it's like, how can we slow down and begin to sort of like unpack what the meanings of those messages were, so we can make sure we are reflecting what we think God would want us to reflect.
Yeah. You know, it makes me think of all the things throughout history where we used them for so long, and then we found out that, hey, this isn't good for us. You know, whether it was lead in paint, or whether it was sugar in in drinks or whatever. And the solution is not to just say, oh, well, all of these things are bad. It's to sort of say, okay, well, what was bad about that, and how can we change it to be different? And right. I think it's so hard to not take some of these things really personally, and to feel that judgment, whether it comes from somebody else or from ourselves, and think that, oh, you know, you're saying that I'm bad because I think this way. No, we're trying to figure out what is unhelpful, what is, you know, causing the damage, and what can we do differently. I wish we could keep talking about this, but I do want to ask one more question. I feel like, oh my gosh, like there's so many different things we haven't even touched yet. but I do want to ask, you know, for people who are out there who are thinking, okay, I still don't know where I land on this, and you and I included, we're still on this journey of learning more. But for people who are coming to this podcast and thinking, wow, like there's so much that I haven't considered, or there's a lot of things that I'm still wrestling through with myself, whether it's my own identity or how I think about gender and sexuality in culture, what would you say in terms of taking some of those first steps to really think critically? Mm-hmm. Because I think, and I'm also asking this within our current political climate, where it seems so hard to find good information beyond just sort of what's in our inner circles, that it's so hard to find information that you can really wrestle with, and that you can sort of pit conflicting ideas against each other and really dig into it really effectively. So what kinds of suggestions, what kinds of advice would you give to people who are trying to really understand this concept more fully?
So I guess I will start with some more abstract ideas before maybe some more practical ones. You know, I think about how we are becoming an incredibly polarized society, like you mentioned, and this makes it so complicated. I think even within the intersection I find myself within my own research in my field is the intersection of sort of like feminist psychology and women's studies and women's issues and psychology of religion. These are pretty contentious crossroads. I think that in many ways, these are conversations that people are not always super friendly to be having. And I think so, I'm not even just thinking about people who are maybe on the more, like they're just learning how to think about this moving one way, but also people maybe who are on the other side of the spectrum and wanting to think about like spirituality and religion and how to make sense for people who are holding some of these views, that we come closer to the middle and allow space to have some dialogue. And I think within that, and again, this is a little bit more abstract as far as like, what should you actually do? But an idea that comes to my mind has to do with fear and how for me, fear was the greatest motivator to not be thinking and to sort of just be going with the flow. And I think so much of the fear messaging was still coming from, like I said, a place of love, which was like the classic idea that comes around is the slippery slope analogy, which is that if we move away from all abstinence, all purity, this way that we've been doing it, we are going to be slipping towards this sort of worldly sexuality, you know, think, Sodom and Gomorrah. Like we're going to just be like trying to sort of like, you know, orgies with angels. Like we're just going to slippery slope into something really bad. And so we have to hold so firmly to what we know. And that makes it so that there isn't the capacity to be critically thinking about like, is that what the Bible says? Is this what's best for men and women? Is this what is the right way to do it? And so I think beginning to be on the lookout for where fear is holding us in stuck patterns, and then be thinking, is there another way we can think about this while continually holding on to the hope that we are in line with what God's truth is and what his purpose for us as people are? Can we hold on to that while also opening doors for more conversations, more discussions, thinking about, you know, Gabriel and I had to write whole comprehensive exams on these questions of how, what does it mean to be a psychologist and study psychology for what it means for the Bible and God's truth? And I, you know, one of the things that I took away from that was that all truth is God's truth. And what we learned from psychology and research, if it's truth, it's all a part of God's truth. So if we're learning that this stuff is not good for people right now, what can we do about that? Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's the idea of learning how to slow down, recognize our own biases, recognize where we are fearful, what we're afraid of, how can we have better conversations? And I think a big part of that, no matter where you land on any of this, is reading stuff and being in conversation with people who fall on a different side from you. This is really hard to do. And I find that like I sometimes don't want to do this, but that if you can hold with some respect what other people are thinking, it actually really opens doors to like clarify your own thinking and making space for that. And I think that is a way to bring unity rather than division is opening doors. You know, I think this is only tangentially related to this conversation today, but you know, at Biola, at one point we got to watch, not live, it was actually pre-taped. We got to watch a conversation between two men, both identified as gay, both fell on different ends of the side A, side B debate, which is whether or not gay people, LGBT people should be able to be in relationships, sexual relationships with people of the same sex. They fell on different ends of the spectrum. What they believed was impactful majorly to the other person, and they were able to have incredibly respectful dialogue in a way that was not only helpful to each other, but it was helpful for those of us who got to watch. And I think the more we can do that, where we can have conversations with each other that are inherently God-honoring because of the respect and love we bring to the table, where we are able to set aside some fear in order to be thinking with each other, we're going to come to truth. We're going to come to things that I think are really good. So that's more my abstract answer. Practically, I think, especially around issues around complementarian, egalitarianism, purity culture, even LGBT issues, read some of the books that are out there, these accounts of people who have lived through it. I think that that is a level of truth that is so holy to me, is the storytelling, the experiences. And so let's say you fall on any of these issues in some way that you're like, this is what the Bible says, and we have to stick with it. The reality is there are people who are living through that and it's hurting them. So whether or not you're going to change your theological stance, a lot of the ways that we are doing things in the church right now are not good for people. It's not helping them. And in fact, sometimes the only answer they can find is leave the church, sever their relationship with Jesus. And that cannot be our best work we're doing. So I think reading the stories with an open heart, and again, like there's plenty of them, is my other piece of advice.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Like, as I said before, you know, and I don't just appreciate the content you bring, but also the posture and disposition that you come at with. these very difficult questions. So thank you for sharing it, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you
for tuning in to the Hard Questions, No Answers podcast. Still have questions? Oh, good. I was afraid we answered them all. For more information about the HQ&A podcast, visit drgabelowe.com. That's drgabelowe.com. Additional educational materials recommended by my guests can be found in the podcast tab. And for updates, news, and behind the scenes, follow HQ&A Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at HQ&A Pod. HQ&A Podcast is independently produced by Gabriel Lowe. Music is Cocktail Fun by Stock Music 331, found on Pond 5. And logo design is by Kenny Lowe. Stay tuned for new episodes released each Wednesday. And thank you for joining me on the journey of No Answers.